Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. It's a great honor tonight to introduce Rita Dove and to tell you a little bit about this marvelous book. You were just listening to Beethoven's Violin Sonata No. 9 in A Major, commonly known as the Kreutzer Sonata. We were listening to Gidon Kremer and Martha Argerich play it, and this is an essential part of tonight's program. The sonata was originally dedicated to the violinist George Bridgetower, who lived 1780 to 1860, who is the protagonist of Rita Dove's brilliant poem cycle, Sonata Melodica, A Life in Five Movements and a Short Play. It's a work that blends history, imagination, truth, and invention. George August Polgreen Bridgetower, who you're going to hear about, the violin prodigy at the heart of Dove's story, was the son of a white Polish serving woman and a black man who claimed to be an African prince. Making their appearance on the stage of this remarkable and musical chronicle are Franz Joseph Haydn, Bridgewater's tutor, a seedy group of grave robbers who steal Haydn's head, Thomas Jefferson, Mrs. Papendieck, a real-life hostess who kept a diary during Bridgetower's stay, and, of course, Ludwig van Beethoven has to make an appearance as well. Rita Dove, the author of this marvelous work, is the recipient of many honors, among them the Pulitzer Prize, the National Humanities Medal, and the NAACP Great American Art Award. Among her poetry collection, among her publications are the poetry collections The Yellow House on the Corner, Museum, Thomas and Beulah, Grace Notes, Selected Poems, Mother Love, On the Bus with Rosa Parks, and American Smooth, a book of short stories, Fifth Sunday, the novel Through the Ivory Gate, and the play The Darker Face of the Earth, which had its world premiere at Ashland at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Ms. Dove is currently Commonwealth Professor of English at the University of Virginia. Tonight you'll hear Rita Dove read some of Sonata Melodica, and then she'll be joined in conversation by Gail Eichenthal, Director of Arts Programming at Classical KUSC 91.5 FM, which is our media sponsor. We're very, very, very grateful to have their support. Gail is the producer and the host of the Saturday talk show Arts Alive. She's an accomplished journalist who's interviewed many great writers, scientists, statesmen, and artists over the years. She's the longtime host and producer of the LA Philharmonic's radio broadcast, as well as the producer of nationally syndicated radio broadcasts by the LA Chamber Orchestra and LA Opera. So after Ms. Dove reads, she'll be joined by Gail for a conversation, then we'll open it up to you for some questions. We circulate a mic because we do record for podcast, so we'll wait till it comes around to you. And afterwards, Ms. Dove will be signing her new book in the lobby. Please join me in welcoming the former U.S. Poet Laureate of the United States to the LA Public Library. Please welcome Rita Dove. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Louise. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you all for coming, and I'm looking forward to this conversation with you. But first, let me read for you a few poems, just a smattering, from this book, Sonata Melodica, because it is a different kind of poetry book. It does tell the story of a life, of many lives, and of a time. And to give you a sense of that, I'll start with the first poem, but then I'll skip around and give a few more poems in between. This story is true. I mean, this is what's so remarkable about it, that this mixed race violin prodigy could have walked the streets of London and Vienna and played and met Beethoven, and yet we still don't know him at all. He really, truly dropped out of history. And Beethoven had dedicated the sonata to him, then they actually liked each other and went around together. And because of that, according to Bridge Tower, they broke up because Bridge Tower made a saucy remark, as he says, about a girl that Beethoven liked as well. And that was the end of that friendship and the end, in a certain way, of Bridge Tower's brief moment of fame. I'll read you the first poem, and we'll go from there. It's called The Bridge Tower. If was at the beginning. If he had been older, if he hadn't been dark, brown eyes ablaze in that remarkable face, if he had not been so gifted, so young a genius with no time to grow up, if he hadn't grown up undistinguished to an obscure old age. If the piece had actually been, as Kreutzer exclaimed, unplayable, even after our man had played it, and for years no one else was able to follow, so that the composer's fury would have raged for naught, and wagging tongues could keep alive the original dedication from the title page he shredded. Oh, if only Ludwig had been better looking, or cleaner, or a real aristocrat, fun instead of the unexceptional fun from some Dutch farmer, if his ears hadn't already begun to squeal and whistle, if he hadn't drunk his wine from lead cups, if he could have found true love, then the story would have held. In 1803, George Polgreen Bridgetower, son of Friedrich Augustus, the African prince, and Maria Anna Sowinki of Biala in Poland, traveled from London to Vienna, where he met the great master, who would stop work on his third symphony to write a sonata for his new friend, to premiere triumphantly on May 24th, whereupon the composer himself leapt up from the piano to embrace his lunatic mulatto. Who knows what would have followed? They might have palled around some, just a couple of wild and crazy guys strutting the town like rock stars, hitting the bars for a few beers, a few laughs, instead of falling out over a girl nobody remembers, nobody knows. Then this bright-skinned papa's boy could have sailed his 15-minute fame straight into the record books, where, instead of a Regina Carter or Aaron Dworkin or Boyd Tinsley sprinkled here and there, we would find rafts of black kids scratching out scales on their matchbox violins so that someday they might play the impossible. Beethoven's Sonata No. 9 in A Major, Opus 47, also known as the Bridge Tower. Thank you. Kreutzer actually never played it. Beethoven dedicated it to Kreutzer, who was a famous violinist of the time, and Kreutzer took a look at the score and said it was impossible. He did say Beethoven did not understand the violin. So, okay. How did this young boy even get out on the stage for the first time with a violin? Well, his father was a personal valet to a Hungarian prince. It sounds like an opera, doesn't it? But it's usually true. He was a personal valet. No one knows how he got there, but there he was on the estate of the Esterházys. And Haydn, Franz Joseph Haydn, was also on this estate. He was the musical director. And at the same time, this little boy seemed to have music in him. And so Haydn gave him lessons. And that's how, at the age of 9, already young Bridge Tower was playing on the stages of Europe. But this poem is Haydn's poem, because Haydn also managed to, his life kept intertwining with Bridge Tower. He followed Bridge Tower's path. He went to London, because London was a place you went if you wanted to do music. And one thing we have to remember, I think it's not so different today, but a musician is pretty much beholden to keep producing, and that tug of trying to make it seem effortless to compose something and then having to compose something for a specific occasion was really difficult. So this is Haydn talking. It's called Haydn Overheard, composing the First London Symphony, number 93 in D major. It is a sad thing always to be a slave, but if slave I must, better the oboe's clarion tyranny than a man's cruel whims. I stayed on at Esterhazy, writing music for the world between spats and budgets, with no more leave to step outside the gates than a prize egg-laying hen. Even after Miklos died and his tone-deaf son filled the courtyard with military parades, I hesitated. Call it robbing Peter to pay Paul, but I had been homeless once and did not care for hunger. I was content, at times happy. There were commissions sufficient to drown out the prince's baritone and his demand for more and more divertimenti. My proudest thought, that Mozart called me friend. My sweetest remembrance, the black servant's child lowering his violin to smile and whisper in time to the music, Papa. The strangest wages arrived from Spain in recompense for the seven last words of our Redeemer on the cross, a giant chocolate cake spilling gold coins. But the finest gift I ever received was the vision of Johann Peter Salomon with his flamboyant nose and cape swirling across my doorstep. I've come to fetch you, he said. It was December. We set out from Vienna on the 15th for London, that great free city. London was a place to go. It was a place to go if you were going to be a musician. And because you got your music, and you have to remember this, there were no iPods at that time, no way of recording music. You had to get it live. You got it in the theater, or you got it on the street, depending how much money you could give. And while this young boy, he goes with his father, who was quite a flamboyant character. He did call himself the African Prince, and he dressed it as well. He put on anything that looked exotic. So he had a cape, turbans, pantaloons, anything that looked vaguely Oriental. And he dressed his son up that way, too. And they went to London to be noticed. And they were noticed. The Prince of Wales noticed this boy and decided to sponsor him. So you have this incredible sight of these two, this one dark man and his brown son, both dressed up like Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, walking down the streets of London on their way to a concert that the boy's giving. And they walk by street musicians, and one of the most famous street musicians of the time was a man by the name of Black Billy Waters. He was also of African descent. He was a violinist. He fiddled on the street. Black Billy Waters at his pitch. All men are beggars, white or black. Some worship gold, some peddle brass. My only house is on my back. I play my fiddle, I stay on track, give my peg leg, thank you, sire, a jolly thwack. All men are beggars, white or black. And the plink of coin in my gunny sack is the bittersweet music in a life of lack. My only house is on my back. Was a soldier once, led a failed attack in that greener country for the Union Jack. All men are beggars, white or black. Crippled as a crab, sugary as sassafras. I'm Black Billy Waters, and you can kiss my sweet ass. My only house weighs on my back. There he struts like a Turkish crackerjack. London queues for any novelty, and that's a fact. All men are beggars, white or black. And to this bright brown upstart hack among kings, one piece of advice, don't unpack. All the home you'll own is on your back. I'll dance for the price of a mean cognac, sing gay songs like a natural born maniac. All men are beggars, white or black. So let's scrape the catgut clean, stack the cords three deep. See, I'm no quack, though my only house is on my back. All men are beggars, white or black. Thank you. The father is sent away because he is too charming to the ladies, and he oversteps himself. And so he is sent, he's actually banished from England. And now you have this young boy with the best job a musician could hope for. He's playing in the Prince's Orchestra. He's 10 years old, without a father, without a language, you know, without a real home. The first thing the prince says is, we've got to get you out of those clothes. The undressing. First the sash, peacock blue. Silk unfurling round and round until I'm the India ink dotting a cold British eye. Now I can bend a peel off my shoes, try to hook the tasseled tips into the emerald sails of my satin pantaloons. Farewell, Sir Monkey Jacket, monkey red, adieu, shirt, tart and bright as the lemons the prince once let me touch. Goodbye, lakeside meadow, goodbye, hummingbird throat, no more games. I am to become a proper British gentleman, cuffed and buckled with breeches and a fine cravat. But how? My tossed bed glows, while I am a smudge, a quenched wick, a twig shrouded in snow. He does grow up, and I'm going to end with this poem, which is much later. He's in his mid-20s. He grows up. He is playing in the Prince's Orchestra. He has a good life. But he wants more. He wants to experience the best music that there is. And what he has heard is that Beethoven is pretty crazy, but crazy in a great way, and he wants to meet him. And so he gets leave to go to Venice, go to Vienna, and meets Beethoven, and indeed Beethoven recognizes in him a like soul, and he stops work and on his other pieces and begins to compose the sonata for Paul Green. Beethoven often would, you know, compose right up to the very last minute, and in fact, he was writing on this or working on this sonata until about 3 a.m. in the morning before the concert. The concert was at 7 a.m., so it was not a lot of time. You know, he was really pushing it. And Paul Green, or George Paul Green, Bridge Tower, had to sight read quite a lot of it for the concert. In this poem, and I'll end with this one, and then invite Gail up, and we can talk further. But in this poem, you see these two like minds, these speaking through music. Paul Green. Sight reading. Harder to play long than fast. It's more than stretching a line. Suspension is what we yearn for, that delicate fulcrum between crash and sheer evaporation, a dissipating breeze. To levitate strands of melodic sound across all the mired avenues we barge along daily, this shining wire, so light, so strong, we can just make out, there it goes, and follow, slip note by note along, and fly, float in that radiant web. Adagio sostenuto, sustained slowness, not water, but the invisible current a dove's wing skims. Not air, but the agency that stirs it. Not light, but spark. No, the dark thread between sparks. How your eye can read a firefly's glimmering trail while the rest of you is long gone, darting leaf to leaf, touching down as a piano poised to intercept that bright cursive, descends growling with a meteor deliquescence. He frightens me. I've never heard music like this man's, this sobbing in the midst of triumphal chords, such ambrosial anguish, jigs danced on simmering coals. Oh, I can play it well enough. Hell, I've been destined to travel these impossible switchbacks. But it's as if I'm skating on his heart, blood tracks looping everywhere, incarnadine dips and curves. I'm not making sense. You're making ultimate sense, he seems to say, nodding his rutted, heroic brow. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'll stop there and invite Gail to come up and we'll talk.
Thank you for that beautiful reading. I'm sure I'm not the only person listening who hears music in your words. And I wonder about that intimacy with music that you seem to have as a poet. You have music in your life, and you've had music in your life for a long time. Maybe you could talk about when that started.
I don't even know when exactly it started. It seems like music was always in my life. From the time I was growing up, my parents played music and all kinds of music. I could never tell if I was going to hear a flute sonata in the morning or if it was going to be Bessie Smith. Just depended on what mood my father was in on a Saturday morning. But then when I was 10, it was fourth grade, yes, there was music in the schools, and which doesn't happen that often anymore, fortunately. And we started with Tonette, and then after the Tonette, anyone who wanted to have an instrument could have an instrument. I thought this was an amazing gift, and I chose the cello because it sounded good, so already it was words and music were mixing together. But I played cello for most of my young adult life until I was in my 30s, 40s, and I switched to viola da gamba. But I always had to have music with me. I loved playing in orchestras. I loved playing chamber music. And when I was in college, in fact, I had to make this decision about whether I was going to pursue music or poetry. I loved to play, but I didn't have the nerve to be a solo performer, to be a performer. And I knew you can't play a cello if your knee is shaking. So...
druggists for that now.
I know they do.
We won't get into that.
Hey, no.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, did you say it was the sound of the word cello that you liked?
Yes. I had no idea what a cello was as a 10-year-old. But I knew two things. My brother played the clarinet. He's an older brother, 2 years older. So I didn't want anything to do with the winds because he did that. I had to do something different. So I went to the strings. It's really it's serendipity. And everybody was playing the violin, so I didn't want to do the violin. That left the viola, the bass, or the cello. And you know, I thought, cello, that sounds really warm. It sounds like something you can wrap yourself around. And indeed, you can wrap yourself around it.
This book, even for someone as musical as you are, is deeply researched, and there's excerpts from a diary. You know, there's some historical documents, and clearly this involved research. But there's also a delightful informality to it, and we get that almost right at the beginning when you promise us you'll leave out the boring parts, as you say.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about the tone, because even I, who work at a classical music station, was at first a little bit intimidated by the idea of a book-length collection of poems about classical music, and then I was immediately disarmed by some of the joking that I felt at the very beginning. So it seems like you're trying to put us at ease, almost.
I am trying to put you at ease because I was intimidated to write the book. I thought, you know, my God, you can't touch Beethoven, you know, or Haydn, or even Napoleon, you know, kind of skips through there a little bit. But... you know, the thing that got it for me, first of all, the music, I've always felt this music was revolutionary. I've always felt that Beethoven was always pushing the envelope. And you have to imagine that you heard some of that as you were coming in. It's not like your usual violin sonata where the violin is the, you know, the main, the star. It's a conversation between the two of them, and that was revolutionary. So I always felt that that music was really raw and radical. But there was a wonderful little quote I found from Beethoven where a little note that he sent to Bridgetower when they were friends for the 3 weeks or so they were friends. And he said, why don't you stop by and we'll go get a beer? And it's written like that too, you know. But it's, I said, you know, we're the ones who make BBC drama-like things out of lives which, when they were lived, were absolutely like your life, you know, where they were absolutely contemporary, and they, you know. And so it's hard for us to remember that Beethoven was considered radical in his time, but he was, so.
Well, you really break it up so that not only, you know, do we hear different voices, as you heard a little sample of right there, but almost there are choruses, there are almost symphonic movements. You know, it's almost a piece of music itself, like an Ives symphony with all these different things in it. And then right in the middle, there's a play, which I thought was really quite audacious. Talk about how that happened and what that is all about.
The whole story revolves around that pivotal moment, that moment when Beethoven gets upset at Bridgetower and tears up the dedication or shreds the dedication. And Bridgetower says that he made this saucy remark to a girl, but we don't know much about it. We don't know if that's even true. So, but that's the reason why he fell out of history. So as I was writing this and learning more and more about his childhood and all the characters that came through his life, I kept coming up to that moment, you know, I'm going to have to write about the moment when, in fact, he must say something about a girl. What was the nature of this argument? And though Bridgetower was a very, very good-looking guy, and Beethoven, as we know, was not, and Beethoven was always falling in love, so probably I can imagine this scene. I suddenly realized I didn't want to, it was becoming too important. It was becoming this, you know, moment. And finally I thought, no, I wrote a couple poems which were disasters about that moment. So I thought, no, let's make a farce. It's because it is a kind of sad farce, you know, that moment. And farces were very popular in Vienna at the time, and so I decided to write this play about that pivotal moment, and there are dancing girls in it, and also, it's sort of like, you know, Mad Magazine, mm-hmm. those little plays they had where you sang songs to popular, you sang different words to popular songs, that's what it's really based on, oh. Yeah. But it's also to say, lighten up on that moment so that you'll be able to see it clearly, as opposed to thinking, oh, Beethoven, that kind of thing.
I guess I'm curious about the daring that takes to, here you have a form that is rarely employed today of a narrative, lyric narrative, a full-length poem, in essence, book-length poem, and then you're going to just write a play in the middle of it. So did you have any kind of argument with yourself, like, I can't do that, is like a book-length poem?
Oh, I had lots of arguments, and in fact, my husband can attest to it. I would come out of my room and say, they're going to skin me alive for this one. Then I went back in and kept working on the play. And at first I said, well, let me just get it out of my system and write the farce and get it out of my system, and then maybe I'll... And then I thought, no, this has to come into the middle of this piece. It's comic relief of an odd sort, because it's comic, but at the same time it's essentially really, really tragic, that moment. And I just
the
feel...
The tiniest little thing that happened that would happen in a bar,
yeah.
that you might tell, you know, your friend over, you know, the water cooler the next day, oh, somebody flirted with this guy I really like, that was it, you know. And here we sort of changed history Could have gone one way, it went another way.
It went another way,
yeah.
And in a way, the farce is a way of saying, you know, I'm laughing to keep from crying. You know, you laugh about it because it's just too heartbreaking otherwise.
This idea of a collection of poems as narrative goes way back in time, to the Odyssey, I guess. Talk about your decision to go to this forum. You've done similar things in the past. What is in it for you? What is the draw for you?
It's interesting because you said Odyssey, and I smiled because I remembered these books, the Iliad and the Odyssey, in my father's bookshelf. He had gotten the great books of the Western world, you know, this, where supposedly if you read those 54 volumes, I forget, something like 54, you've got all of it. And it started with the Iliad. And as a kid, I would look at this and think, I've got to start there. There's the Iliad. And I tried to read it, and I thought I was reading it, and I didn't understand anything, but I loved reading it, even though I didn't understand it. The idea that something like this could be so musical and still tell a story, that it could do both, that to me goes deep and goes far back. I think that narrative poetry has gotten such a bad rap, and I don't understand why there is such a reluctance for young poets today to write narrative poems. I think they're difficult. I think it's difficult to write a poem that, quote unquote, tells a story or has a sense of a story without it descending into prose. And I'm not saying that as if prose is something that is lower than poetry, just a different kind of language. To my mind, poetry should be stretched. We do have nine muses, after all, and several of them deal different kinds of poetry, from lyric poetry to musical things. So, and historical. So we have nine muses. Why not use all of them? To me, that this couldn't have been written any other way. There are lyric moments in the narrative strain. There are narrative moments in poems which are pure lyrics. I think a lyric is nothing more than an interrupted storyline. Just catch them right in that moment and turn them around.
Where did you find some of the stuff that is referred to, like the diaries of this woman that worked for Queen Charlotte, and, you know, just amazing window on what was going on in time?
Well, thank God for the internet, I must say, because that was my first line of inquiry. I discovered George Bridgetower in a way through the internet because I had seen, very quickly, I'd seen, my husband and I were watching a movie one night, Immortal Beloved. It's about Beethoven, his whole life. And there was a scene in there where Beethoven walks past a group of musicians, and one of them is a black violinist. And we're kind of looking at each other like, colorblind casting? I don't think, what's going on in this scene? I said, I have to find out. So I went upstairs and I Googled. I just said, black violinist Beethoven. And up popped this little teeny article on Bridgetower, and that's the way it started. From then, I was just curious to know who he was, and I started to look. And the first line was just to keep Googling until I found things. What I discovered was that there was a reference to a Mrs. Papendieck in an article from a musical quarterly that came out in Britain. And I said, well, who was she? And she had helped to organize his first concert in England. And then I kept looking, and I discovered, and this was the real miracle, this woman had written volumes and volumes of diary entries. And she did it because her children thought that she was sad. She had had an operation, and she was recuperating, and she was getting old. And they said, Mom, just write down all of your experiences at court. She had been the wardrobe keeper for Queen Charlotte, who was married to Mad King George III. And because of this woman, who nobody knows, again, you know, another person nobody knows, who wrote all the stuff down with meticulous attention to clothing because she was a wardrobe keeper, so it's, everything is just, she knows everybody, what they're wearing and whether this color suits. But she wrote about the father, she wrote about the son, and these first concerts, the kind of stuff you don't get in history, the kind of behind-the-scenes stuff that led me to something else. You know, so that's, so she mentioned someone else who happened to be there. I started to look for them to see if they had mentioned, had said anything. And that's how it grew. It grew in a kind of a messy way. It wasn't exactly, I don't think I would get a doctoral dissertation passed in history because of it, but.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's kind of a cumulative sense of tragedy for all of the lighter moments, and there are some very funny things in this book, as we heard. But there really is a sense of this poor young boy was abandoned by his father. The father left, and there he was, a stranger. Mm-hmm. And then you would think, okay, well, that's really a romantic story about, and he became so famous. But he didn't.
No.
So it kind of, I guess he had a musical career, but it ended more or less in obscurity, didn't it?
It did. I mean, what I find even oddly more tragic is the fact that he also didn't have that Hollywood, you know, totally in the gutter at the age of, you know, 30 and, you know, strung out somewhere.
He wasn't Lindsay Lohan.
Yeah. he had a fairly okay life as a musician. He continued to play, but he'd had a taste of that kind of fame and beauty, I think, because of the music, and it was taken from him, and so that was it.
And he lived a fairly long life.
He lived to be 80.
Isn't that something?
And he was 23 when he premiered the sonata. So you could see all those years after that when he was not. A long, slow decline.
There's a lot of fact in here, and there's also some fiction. And your imagination obviously came to play. Is that a difficult balance to, you know, to have this kind of very, very clear documentation, these diaries, Beethoven's letters that we have, and then kind of taking off from there and then coming back, you know, so in and out of really a documented story?
Right. It was difficult. What I did was something that I've never done with any other book. Because the world was so different in this book, and I had to get to a point where I forgot that it was different. I had to get to the point where I didn't know what was real or not in order to really feel that I was getting to that world. I pretty much shut myself off for a while. I had a sabbatical coming up, so I had this year free, and I didn't accept any engagements. I didn't even answer the phone. For professional things, you know, for family, sure, but not, you know, anyone else. And then what I did was I would do research when it drove me, but then I'd put it away, and I wouldn't look at it for months, and I would write without thinking about the research. So that, and then afterwards I'd go back and check and make sure the facts were right. You just want to make sure the dates and the chronology. But I never worked with a timetable at my side, because that would have kept me out of the world. I would have just only been like floating on top. In the end, I must say, and it sounds kind of romantic, but it isn't really. I think I felt like I was in Haydn's skin. I felt like I was in his head. I felt like Beethoven. I missed Haydn a lot. I really liked Haydn. You know, I would talk to them. I was a crazy woman. Let's face it.
Did you listen to a lot of music?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. And tonight, it was so interesting because I was listening to the the sonata. Sonata
should have been called Bridge Tower.
The Bridge Tower. Yeah, I can't even say that anymore, Kreutzer. But it just, I started humming. I know every single note and breath of that thing because I just played it constantly, and other pieces too. All of Haydn. I think my husband is to be commended. He had to listen to this nonstop.
Doesn't sound that bad.
No, but you know, every day in and out. I mean, you know, all and so. And then, of course, I would go into it's such a male book. There are really very few females in the book. In that sense, it was sometimes hard to get into that. That was one of the hardest things. And I would kind of sometimes stomp out of the room and say to Fred, my husband, you guys are just awful. And then I would walk back. Because women didn't matter. And even the nicest people, the nicest men in the book, you know, just, the women just didn't matter. It drove me crazy.
Yeah, Beethoven wasn't very nice to those women that he was trying to court. So we find out. Having Beethoven as almost a sort of having a supporting role in a book in itself, I think, is very audacious. And, you know, there's a tragic story. Although he had fame, needless to say, but he didn't have much of a life. And you capture some of that agony that he felt as he was becoming deaf. There's a particular period in his life when he's out in the country writing to his brothers about... that the world doesn't know how he's suffering.
Right, right.
And he would have ended his life if he didn't have his art. Talk a little bit about that character and how it felt to go there.
I was terrified at first to presume to speak for Beethoven or through Beethoven because he's that marble bust on the piano. You know, he's just, and then this letter that he wrote to his brothers, this called the Heiligenstadt Testament, is so much, it's so moving. And you think, this is Beethoven? Is this the Beethoven that we know, the one with the rages and the stormy man? And I realized that I was falling into the same trap that Bridge Tower is suffering from, which people looked at him only at the surface. I was only looking at the surface of Beethoven. And once I thought about it, I thought about what it was like to be that brilliant and that to have this gift and yet lose your hearing, to be short and swarthy, so dark that people called him the Moor at times, ugly, and be revered by, or treated, not revered, but kind of adored, let's say, by a musical public who would not invite you to their drawing room. And suddenly that all didn't matter anymore, and I could kind of get into his character. And,
And then, again, another big step is trying to describe the sense of hearing music in words, something that I don't think a whole lot of people have even attempted. But you do a magnificent, almost breathtaking job of it. And was that a kind of leap, or did you always know you were going to try to give a sense of how music affects one in words?
I think that one way to stretch any kind of art is to try to describe another art through it. And when I was in college, one of my professors, writing professors, actually said to us, he said, "Don't try to describe music. You'll fail." So, of course, I said, "Well, that's where I'm going." Because I thought, why not? Music meant so much to me. It moved me so deeply that I had to write about it. So you have to find a way to write about it, though. You know, it can't Yes, just so it was one of the things I tried to do, and I knew I was going to have to do in this, and describe many kinds of music, from Black Billy Waters to Beethoven.
Well, you do it brilliantly. Go back to when you first discovered poetry and decided that writers could be real people, grown-ups, you know.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because I was writing poetry when I was a kid, but I thought it was kid stuff. Basically, you do it, and I loved it, but I had never met a writer. And it didn't occur to me that I could become a writer. No one said nay to that idea, but it just didn't appear on the horizon. When I was in college, actually it was earlier, my high school English teacher, who's still alive and I see her every year, took a group of us on a Saturday to a book signing. She called our parents. She didn't even tell us. She called our parents, said, can I take them out to see John Chardy, poet and translator, who was in town in Akron. He had come to Akron, Ohio, of all places, for a book signing. And she took us there, and there was a living writer. I had not read anything by John Chardy at that point, but there was a book with his name on it, you know? And it was actually the translation of Dante's Inferno that he had just done. But suddenly something clicked in my head. I said, that's a living person. He's making a living doing this thing that you love. And that's where it started.
So you decided to study English?
Well, I didn't quite decide. What I did was, because... I think growing up is a really middle class, first generation middle class African American. There are three things you could do if you went to college: you became a doctor, a lawyer, or a teacher, some variant of that. And no one said I had to do that, but I knew that's what I was supposed to do. So I went to school in pre-law, which would have been an utter disaster for every paper of the law. And I rapidly realized that was not where I belonged. But I stayed in English, because you'd be in English and still be pre-law. And so basically I kind of said to my parents, oh, I'm pre-law, I'm doing English. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew what I loved. And so I kept taking the courses that I loved. And then I really literally stumbled into a creative writing class, and it was not supposed to be a creative writing class. It was a advanced composition class, which I had to take for English. And the professor became ill 6 weeks into the class. The fiction writing professor came to take over and said, we're writing stories. And that was my first creative writing class. I thought, you can take classes in this? You know, it was stunning. And so that's what I did until I was about a junior, and then I went home and confessed that I wanted to be a poet.
I had the great honor of interviewing you while you were Poet Laureate some years ago. And I think, tell me if this is, my recollection is that this teacher said, I guess he was taking over the class, we're going to tell stories, who's going to start?
Yeah.
Just like that.
Yeah, that's what he did.
Who's going to tell a story?
Yes, and he went around the room and he said, tell me something, catch my attention. And we're all terrified. You know, what's this? But it was amazing because he'd say a couple words and he'd say, and what color was that? And could you smell that? And before long, we were all telling stories. Yeah.
And also, just the idea as a poet, somebody getting you to think about how to get people's attention, because you don't have a long time to get somebody's attention when you're writing a poem.
No. Where do you start the story? Where do you start the moment if you're doing lyric poetry? At what point do you put your audience into the story? It's so important.
And you felt early on that you were poetry rather than prose. I know you've done both. You've published both.
I think I knew all along. Poetry is my real love because for me it is the absolute bones of the language. It's where it all begins. But on the other hand, I also know And I don't know why I know, but I do know if I have an idea, if I get a line or if I get a character, I know whether it's going to be a story, a novel, a play, or a poem. I just know instinctively, and I don't know why. I don't know.
I would guess you have to rely on that instinct quite a bit,
yes,
as a writer, period. Not just for what form is this going to take, but these words work.
Right, these words work, yes. Which means a lot of pacing up and down and trying to hear them as well.
Do you do a lot of rewriting?
Oh, yes. Oh, I love rewriting. It's masochistic, perhaps, to say so, but I love, with this book, I mean, I would like stack up the revisions. There could be like 30, 40 revisions of a poem. That's not a problem. You know, and I love to see the pages pile up, and it's weird. It's weird, but because you see, the revision process can have an idea, but and or even a line, or even a moment of entry into a poem, but the words have to help in a certain way massage our sensibilities into seeing it exactly the way that I want it to be seen. And that means really finding not only the right word, the word that sounds right and that means right, if we can say that, but words which give you the right form of mouth. Words, then you line them up, and then it becomes, how do you breathe when you read this line? Does it make you tense? Does it make you loose? Do you have to keep going? How do you want your... So all of that stuff is involved, and that means lots of revisions.
So it's really an oral creation for you.
For me, it is. Even though I love to see it on the page, it's also a visual presentation on the page of how much white space is around your poem. And how does that make the words feel? How does it make you feel when you look at it? So it's all of those things, but the oral is always there for me. If a poem doesn't sing its own music, I'm not interested. You know? I'm just not.
Talk about what you learned about the way people hear and feel about poetry when you were U.S. Poet Laureate. What does it mean to be Poet Laureate?
Being Poet Laureate is like, it's sort of like being like Miss America poetry. In that you don't have, you know, you have no real duties, but you have lots of attention on you, and you have to figure out what to do. And when I was Poet Laureate, I was the first one, well, one of the first ones who really started doing things in the role, being active. And I didn't know what I was supposed to do. I didn't have a real budget. I asked, and they looked at me blankly.
You're just supposed to like the name. And
yeah, and I thought, okay. I did have one duty, that was to plan a reading series at the Library of Congress, and that was really great to be able to invite poets and come to record. But beyond that, I said, well, if there's no budget, I'll just go until they stop me. What else can you do? I mean, what happened was incredible. People began to write letters, and I would get letters from lawyers, housewives, musicians, carpenters, all over the place. A girl named Pizza. I never knew a real name, but she wrote me a lot. She was a teenager. And she had all these ideas, and they all did, for how to promote poetry. Why? Why did they want to promote poetry? Well, they weren't all poets. They would say things, most of the letters would start out with, I don't know much about poetry, but. Or, I really don't understand a lot of poetry today, but. And then they would describe, sometimes in the most amazing way, their first encounters with poetry. You know, a man who lived in rural Kansas, and he described the bookmobile had come through, and by the time he got his first card when he was a 12-year-old, by the time he got it all signed up and everything, he only had time for just grabbing a book, and he just grabbed the first book he saw, and it was Paul Laurence Dunbar's. And this is a little white boy, you know, in Kansas going, oh. But then he said he read it, and it changed his life, you know. That's kind of, when you hear stuff like that, as a poet laureate, I thought, what I have to do is actually just go out, meet people, bring poetry into their lives, you know, so it isn't something that we're either embarrassed to say that we love or afraid that we don't understand, because everybody really understands poetry. Poetry is us.
Thank you. I'm sure I'm not alone in saying that, you know, when I have really, really tough times, sometimes there's the only thing I can turn to is poetry. Mm-hmm. The only thing, even beyond music, actually. And yet, you say, you know, people are afraid of poetry. They feel like, you know, they're going to have the wrong answer. They didn't analyze it correctly. Yeah, Somebody told them that in eighth grade or whatever. Did you find that you were coming up against that wall, that, you know, there's still a lot of fear out there about poetry?
Oh, yes, there is a lot of fear. And I think that, you know, I think it starts in the schools, and I hate to say that, but I think it's a sticky wicket, as the British would say, because teachers are bound by curricula, because they have to prove that their students have, that the kids have learned something, that makes poetry one of the hardest things to teach, because they have to come up with a grid. They have to say, this is what the poem means, repeat after me. And the problem is, I think, is that when you were really moved by something deeply, like a poem, you're speechless. So how can you possibly talk about the thing that just moved you so deeply? Using words, because poems use words. We can talk about music sometimes, or art, because they don't use words, because we use words then to describe how this made us feel. But somehow, I think there's this short circuit that goes on. You know, the best words are already used, so how could you presume? Yeah, that kind of thing.
Good point.
So it's a real tricky thing. Now, what I would love to do, if, you know, I were king or something, would be to say, from the time of kindergarten, every day, the teacher should just read a poem at the end of the day, and then say, goodbye, go home, you know. And don't explain it, don't do anything, just send them off. If this were done, even if it were done once a week, after a while the kids would start talking back and say, read that one again, or we didn't like that one you did yesterday. But they would live with the poems. You see, it would be great.
Yeah, and it wouldn't take up that much time of the curriculum either.
No, only like 3 minutes. By the time they were, I think kids were 12, they would already be talking about the poems and writing about them and not afraid of them.
You know, you make such an excellent point. It occurs to me, you know, I took some classes in music theory, and you can analyze a piece of music, at least in that kind of scientific way of that D major and A minor, and, you know, this is the development section. You can be right or wrong about that.
Yeah.
But how can you be right or wrong about a poem, what a poem means? You know,
no. I mean, you can come up with some really wild interpretations. That's true, but you can't really be right or wrong. You can just say these aspects. Yeah.
So, was it a frustrating couple of years? Was it rewarding? How do you look back on it?
It was really fun. It was frustrating too, but it was also fun. Yeah. What happened was that kind of miraculously. Interest kept growing, and they began to find money. That's how Washington works. They found money, so that the budget was, there never was a budget, but if the project looked interesting enough, they would try to find some money somewhere. I don't know where they got it from. So what I found really fascinating about the whole thing was that it did give me an opportunity to meet people all over the country and just talk about poetry. I had the best job in the world.
That's pretty good. Since we have some young, perhaps budding poets or future poets in the audience.
Hey, guys.
There's something very interesting that I've read that you kind of thought poetry had to be formal and flowery, and then you discovered a poem by Sylvia Plath that suddenly turned your head around.
Yes, the poem was Daddy, where, you know, which is a scathing poem. I think a lot of you may know it, but, you know, it ends basically with Daddy, you bastard, I'm through. So you know what the tone of the poem is. It's formally such an incredibly rigorous and beautifully structured poem, but it is a poem of such anger. And I thought, you mean a poem can hate?
Doesn't have to be polite.
It doesn't have to be polite. It doesn't have to be about something beautiful. And that really was quite an eye-opener for me. Because the poems that I had read and studied in school they were in control of themselves. They were very dignified poems. The idea that you could just get out there and, you know, spill it was incredible. And then other kinds, well, yes, we'll leave it at that for now. That's probably enough.
But poetry can run the whole gamut of emotions, not necessarily just a love poem.
Right, right.
Yeah.
In fact, it's really hard to write a love poem. You know, that's one of the hardest things to do.
Why is that?
I think because you're happy when you're writing. You know, if you're happy, you don't want to write. Let's be really honest about this.
Wait a minute.
No,
your husband is here.
No, but you want to live. You want to live. That's what we all want to do. We want to live intensely. And all of the arts are about helping us live intensely by recalling moments, by pulling out our emotions. It's really hard to write about something happy because when you're happy, you just want to go and enjoy it. I think that's part of it.
Very interesting. Well, I know I should share you with our audience. I'm sure there are some questions from our audience. And let's see, there are microphones, mobile microphones. So raise your hand. And I see, a woman in red, second row.
Hi. Oh, is this on? Hello?
Not working.
No. One pretty loud.
Here comes another one.
Oh, okay, thanks. You are a genius. I just want to say that. And I want to thank you for sharing your genius and not becoming a lawyer. Now that that's out of the way. I just have a simple question. I wanted to know, what is your relationship with your old poems? How do you feel when you look back at your first book? How do you feel about your old poems? Do you ever say, oh, I hate those, why did I write those? Or do you say, I'm so proud that I've come? I mean, what is your relationship?
It's actually a very difficult question you just asked. You know, it depends. A lot of times, old poems feel like someone else wrote them. What's so curious about the way that writers live their lives these days that we go off and we read from the most recent book, and then the older books you never read from anymore. And every once in a while I'll look back and say, gosh, did I write that? Did I really write? And there are some that I don't like anymore. And there are some poems that are old favorites that I just kind of wish I could read again. But for the most part, the process of writing becomes for me it's an intensely personal thing that then becomes less and less personal as I revise the poems so that I'm ready to give them to someone else. By the time it's published and to give it to someone else, it almost feels like, you know, a stranger. And in fact, I have a very difficult time when the first books appear, you know, first publication of a book, I have a very difficult time opening it. I leave it in the box. My husband walks in. Are you gonna open the box at least? Are you gonna like open the book and then he'll open it? He says, it looks okay. And I said, that's not the point. It just doesn't feel like mine.
Let's take one from our young group here. Okay. Yeah, the gentleman right next to you in the glasses had a question.
What inspired you to become a poet?
What inspired me to become a poet? Oh, so many things, actually. I think music in a certain way inspired me to become a poet. I love to read. From the time I was young, I read and read and read. And to me, it seemed incredible that you could go into a library and get a book about anything in the world for free. That was amazing. You could go anywhere in the world. And I think I really blossomed in the library when I was about your age. I wanted, and the next step then became, I wanted to write books where people like me appeared, you know? So it was a gradual process, but that's what first inspired me to become a poet. Reading and music.
Yeah. In the front row?
Dear Ms. Dove, I recently recited Exit at my school, and I found it incredibly amazing. Can you explain why you wrote Exit, and was it an experience you had in your life?
Wow. It's great. For the other people in the audience, Exit is a poem that appears in a book called Mother Love, and there's the scene is of a woman standing, getting ready to leave. I mean, getting ready to leave out of a relationship, and she's standing at the doorway about to go down the street. And I think all of us have had similar scenes. I didn't have exactly that experience, but exactly that physical experience of standing there with a suitcase, ready to strike out. But that there are moments in your lives, in our lives, and there will be moments in your life too, where you can stop and look around and think, something's changed. Something has changed. I'm about to leave this past behind and move into a future. And so that's the autobiographical sense of it. The poem was inspired by that's a book that deals with mothers and daughters and mothers leaving daughters leaving and mothers watching their daughters leave. My daughter at that time was fairly young. She was about 10, I think, or 12, something like that. But she was about to go through adolescence, so she was already leaving me. You know what I mean? So, thank you.
Let's take one more from that corner. Yes, sir, in the back row.
For all of your poems, have you ever exaggerated them or lied to make them better? Or you say it as it is?
All the time. No. I wouldn't call it lying. But
poetic license.
Poetic license is what we call it. For instance, I'll give you an example. There's a book, Thomas and Beulah is a book of mine. It's my third book. It's the one that got the Pulitzer. It tells very loosely the story of my maternal grandparents. There's a scene in there where the man, Thomas, is courting his wife-to-be, and he gives her a scarf, and the scarf is yellow. And there's a description of the scarf was yellow as if it were melting. You know how it drapes. The original scarf was blue. And I had heard this story from my mother, before about how my grandfather had given my grandmother this blue scarf. And I changed the color. So I did lie, you could say. But why did I change it? I changed it because I wanted it to melt. And I couldn't get blue to melt.
That's a very good reason. Okay. Yes, the gentleman in the first row.
Earlier you mentioned that your interest in narrative poetry, and you feel that the youth don't seem to have an interest toward doing that, and you didn't know why. I'd like to hazard a guess. if I may, and see what you think. It, because I'm a fan of narrative poetry, either narrative poetry as well. And I read the Iliad when I was 13, so I did things like that when you was a kid. I believe that possibly because of today's contemporary society, there's so much stimulus, it's created a short-term attention span within possibly the contemporary generations. And so even if someone were to write a narrative poem, who would listen to it within their generation? And so I wonder, what do you think about that?
It's very interesting. I mean, I think that the whole loss of esteem, I guess, that narrative poetry has had goes back even further. I think it goes back to about the 60s. Mid-60s is where it began to happen. And it's true that by mid-60s we were starting to have a very different way of looking at reality. You know, film was getting much tighter with a lot of cuts, and you know, you don't tell a straight line. You've got to do it in some kind of kaleidoscopic fashion. So that's where it starts, I think. And I do think it's true that if someone were to write a long Iliad today, I don't know how many people would say, "Oh, I got to read that," you know, right now. They go, "Oh," and this book is pretty fat for a poetry book. You know, it's a kind of scary thing. And I've had people tell me, you know, "Oh, I don't know. It was hard to pick it up because it seems like a lot to go through." I also think that narrative poetry is, again, it comes to ease of teaching. If you have a short poem, you have a lyric poem, a poem that fits on a page, it's a lot more portable, it's a lot easier to make a lesson plan around a lyric poem and to spin off of it. A narrative poem may require pages. I think that's one of the things that contributed to this demise of the narrative poem. Thank you.
It was also the way we told stories back then, too. Yeah. I mean, it was a really important form of storytelling, wasn't it?
Yes, we listened. There were radio plays. People could listen for hours. Now, what I find interesting is that with the rise of spoken word poetry, we're listening again, and I'm waiting to see where that goes, you know.
Yes. Young woman in the white.
Hi. As a writer,
it's the dead mic.
Okay. As a writer, you have shared a lot about the process of this book, but I'm wondering kind of what your normal writing process is or what your day looks like when you're not on tour and you're actually, you know, just going through life as a writer.
Well, I'm a night person. And when I say that, I mean, if left to my own devices, I would start to write about midnight and would write until the sun came up. I love that. Of course, I can't do that all the time. That's just the way I am. When I was a child in the crib, my mother said that she would wake up at 3 in the morning and hear something, and it would be me playing in the dark in my crib. So that's my clock, obviously. But ideally, what I try to do is clear away, you know, after dinner, which is late, which is like 10 at night, it's usually, or 9:30 at night, and I try to just, it's going to take me 2 or 3 hours to really get into the mood of writing, even though I want to write right away. I don't write on days when I teach. I've realized that doesn't work because I can't get from outward mode to inward mode. But I read. You know, I keep a notebook all the time. I have a notebook with me now. I jot down things. I don't think I'm going to remember them, you know. I don't question anything that strikes my fancy. If I see something, if someone, I overhear something, I don't think, where am I going to fit this No, just put it in the notebook. And usually if I begin, when I begin writing, I will begin by leafing through notebooks. Unless I'm driven at that point to write a certain poem, I'll start leafing through a notebook. If something, I say, oh, you know, something seems to stop me for a minute, I get out a piece of paper and I write it down. I write by hand until I have to get to the typewriter, then I go to the computer. And then I
can revise by hand too?
Yes, I do, actually. Well, what I'll do is I print it out, and then I'll start scribbling on it again. I try to write for as long, by hand, as long as possible, because that way I hear it, and I don't see it. Once it gets typed, it freezes a bit on the page. And so every time that I print out something, I immediately start slashing it up so that it doesn't get set. It's so hard to change then.
Two more questions. Okay. All right. Let's see. We haven't had anyone from this side of the auditorium. So the gentleman in the back row.
Are there any plans to make an audio book of your latest book?
Plans to make an audio book. It's in the works. It's in the works. God, I'd like to make an audio version of the entire book, actually. I'll have to get some people to help me with the play, but... you know, I think that it would be really great to do an audio version of it. So look for it. I'm going to try to do it. Thank you.
One more quick question on this side, and I promise the young man on the other side he'll have it. That was a quick one. Gentleman in the first row.
Thank you. Hi, Miss Dove. Hi. How does your upbringing of your childhood and or heritages of your hometown, Akron, which is where I'm from, of course, play in your influences in your past and present characters and roles in your books?
Ooh, it's a big question. well, you know, Akron, Ohio is a industry town. It's a town of rubber, used to be rubber, and... that meant a whole transplanted population who came up from the South to work in the plants in the 20s. I grew up in a family that, as you know, that my father was the first person in his family who went to college, became a chemist. That meant that all my aunts and uncles, they all worked in the factories. And... more or less, or some factory, they were all working people, blue-collar people. And in my household, in my family, the expectation that we were going to go to college, and there were books, and there was music of all kinds. And then we would go to all of my relatives who also, you know, were good at school and stuff like that, but they didn't have the father who bought all the books, you know. So it's kind of, as a child, you don't think anything about that, but as I grew up older, I realized how our lives had been shaped a little bit differently in my family. I have great cousins and aunts and uncles, and we would get together and we would for all those picnic holidays, you know, and just talk and jabber and storytelling was really important. And so I never felt there was a real difference in that kind of education, that kind of storytelling, and the ones I got from books. Not really. It was a good place to grow up.
And finally, in the third row, this gentleman, yes.
Hi. I'm a little nervous. I have two questions, if it's okay with you. My first question is, in your own opinion, do you think poetry speaks more to people than music?
Do I think it speaks more? I don't think it speaks differently. Let's put it that way.
As in inspire?
Well, yeah. I mean, in the sense that... see, because poetry has words to it, and so its meaning is more pointed than music, I guess you'd say. So, if it is going to move you, it can move you it can inspire you, but music can get inside of you and come up from the bottom too, you know, like poetry. So it just depends. What's the second question?
My second question. Do you think that the nowadays music, like Kanye West and the like rap and hip hop and those other music, inspire more people nowadays, like the kids from now? Like, for instance, a lot of people say when Michael Jackson died, his spirit will stay here. But to me, the kids nowadays, I really don't think his spirit will stay. So do you think that now the rap will come into the kids and hypnotize them in a way to inspire them to do things, or you think it'll still stay like from?
I think we're going to have to wait and see. I mean, I think that a lot of, from my opinion, I think a lot of rap is very commercial and just isn't going to last. But that's the way of all contemporary music. Some will and some won't. There's going to be some great rap that will last as well. Because what rap does, it's really not much different, good rap, I think, than Langston Hughes saying, "Good morning, Daddy, ain't you heard the boogie-woogie rumble of a dream deferred?" I mean, come on. So there are levels of it. I think what you're saying is that is the general, you know, popular rap going to inspire? And I would say probably not. But the really good one, good, great rap song will inspire. So you just have to write that one, you know? That's all.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.